This is an IEEE Computer Society podcast. I'm David Alan Greer, and this is In Our Time. Like so many tasks, the work of counting votes seems to be easy. Hands up, hands down, fill in the form, pull the lever. Yet, mechanized balloting has posed special problems for decades and will likely challenge the body politic for years to come. The nature of these problems is examined in this edition of In Our Time, which is called Counting Beans. Francis and Gerald are the matter and antimatter of American politics. They have never been seen together. If they ever arrived at the same place in both time and space, they would probably annihilate one another in an instant. Francis is an aged lefty. He marched against all those terrible things of the 60s and was arrested several times. For a period, he served as the head of the American Association for the Promotion of Goodness and spoke forcefully against the injustices of this world. For most of his life, he was a strong believer in democracy as the solution for all the world's ills. But that faith ended with the 2000 American presidential election. Sometime in November 2000, well before the election was resolved, Francis caught me on the street. "We have to do something," he said with urgency. "They're stealing the election." "Okay," I said. I've long since learned to be cautious when talking to Francis. "Who are they, and how are they stealing it?" With a brief snort, Francis suggested that I was a naive fool. "The moneyed elite," he said. "The capitalists. They couldn't convince enough people to vote for their candidate, so they're going to change the rules." I've always believed that people are far more likely to be stupid than to be dishonest. It is perhaps one of the failings of my character. I've tried to explain that vote counting was an engineering process and as such had an error rate, a certain percentage of votes that would be incorrectly counted. At the moment, the error rate was larger than the difference between the two candidates. Francis was unimpressed. "They have the bean counters in their pocket," he said with obvious disdain. "It doesn't take much to buy a bean counter." Historically, Francis was wrong on this point. Once upon a time, that time being colonial New England, bean counters were people of demonstrable integrity. They were individuals who oversaw elections. Their name came from the fact that the elections were conducted using dried beans. Voters would indicate their preference by dropping a bean into a jar that was identified with the name of a particular candidate. When everyone had voted, the bean counters would empty the jars and count the beans and declare the winner. If there were not people of integrity, the bean counters could easily have manipulated the outcome. A winning margin could have been pulled from a pocket, a close vote transferred from one pile to another. Or, in the worst case, I suppose, a victorious landslide would be dumped on the ground for the birds to eat. Francis was not interested in learning the history of the bean counters, which I admit is more than a little pedantic. Neither was Gerald, who used the exact same term in a conversation a few weeks later. As I have mentioned, Gerald has a very different political view from Francis. He and I were once attending a meeting at the Washington Institute for the Elimination of Bad Things. At that meeting, Gerald grabbed my arm and began talking loudly. This is the way he begins almost all conversations. "The bean counters are stealing the election," he said. "They're under the control of the liberals and the unions. If we don't do something, there'll be chaos, utter chaos." As with Francis, I tried to explain to Gerald the technical nature of the election process, but he brushed my words aside. "Who cares about technology?" he said. "We have to have a trustworthy election, or democracy is doomed." As the weeks of the fall of 2007 progressed, both Francis and Gerald concluded that the 2000 election represented a major failure of information technology, a failure far more devastatingly visible than the prior year's Y2K problem. Like others, they both wanted immediate reform of voting technology and procedures. One of the first challenges facing the new Congress, editorialized one newspaper, will be to develop a uniform national electoral process that safeguards the sanctity of America's right to vote. Most people, like the writer in the newspaper, thought that the problem of the 2000 election had a straightforward solution. "Stop using punched cards," was the blunt assessment of a report in March 2001. Congress established a commission to identify standard voting technology, electoral boards discarded old machines, and purchased new direct recording electronic devices to capture the vote. They redesigned their balloting systems. While this work generally improved the quality of the next presidential election, the one in 2004, it also created subsequent problems all the more visible. The election brought new claims of voting irregularities and an official challenge to the result. Most damaging was the failure in a 2006 Florida congressional ballot. In this election, new, modern voting machines failed to record some 18,000 votes, one out of every seven ballots cast. A considerable amount of technical investigation has been done into the circumstances of this election, wrote one investigator. But the exact causes are not known with complete certainty. Indeed, they may never be known. Strictly speaking, many of these failures might have been more managerial than technical, caused by the bean counter's actions rather than the failures of voting machinery. However, our current body politic is looking for a more robust voting mechanism, one that is secured by technology rather than the competence and integrity of bean counters. Such work is not easy. One author, writing in Computer Magazine, has noted that a good voting system requires us to balance the often conflicting requirements of our democracy. Secrecy with accountability. Scale with cost. The demands of democracy have increased over the years. The scale and cost have grown most dramatically. In 1800, officials had to count the votes of some 68,000 white landholding men who lived along the Atlantic coast. This election had none of the trappings of the modern election. It had no fixed precincts, no voter registration, and not even a common ballot. Voters wrote their preferences on any available scrap of paper. Such a system would not have been capable of handling the 2000 election, when 104 million individuals cast their votes in jurisdictions spread over six or more time zones. As the scale of the voting process has grown, so has the demand for accountability and secrecy. Secrecy was not an original requirement of the American election system. Indeed, the founders of the country anticipated that voting would be a public activity. The early presidents, including Jefferson, Madison, Jackson, Polk, and even Lincoln, were elected without the widespread use of secret ballots. Through most of the 19th century, voters often used ballots that the candidates, or their political parties, had prepared. These ballots were usually printed on an easily identifiable piece of paper. Such lack of secrecy meant that votes could be easily bought. A political operative could offer a dime and a party ballot to a willing soul and watch as that voter placed the paper in an election box. By 1870, such fraud was common in large cities. New York, as one might expect, had the greatest problem. Several organizations in the city were actively buying votes, the largest being Tammany Hall. For more than two decades, New Yorkers tried to limit the influence of Tammany Hall, with very little success. Tammany workers found it easy to buy votes from immigrants with money, with a drink, or with the promise of a job, or even with a firmly uttered threat. In 1888, New York voting officials gained some control over fraudulent votes with a new technology that was known as the Australian ballot. The Australian ballot is really nothing more than the common paper ballot. Yet, this device has four features that clearly distinguish it from the balloting systems of the time. First, Australian ballots were printed by the states and not by private political organizations. Second, they were distributed and collected by government representatives. Third, they contained the names of all the candidates for each office and grouped these names together. Finally, the ballot was cast in secret. Taken together, these four features made fraud much more difficult. "Bribery is very greatly diminished, almost altogether ceasing," wrote a Massachusetts advocate of the Australian ballot. "Although we hear these rumors of bribery, there is no doubt that the new voting system has placed great obstacles in its way." A few political organizations bragged that they could still control elections. "Oh, we're on to the new law," proclaimed a New Jersey political leader. But a local newspaper doubted his statements. "It is scarcely to be believed that they would proclaim new villainies in advance if they had found a means of committing them," the newspaper observed. The paper concluded that such statements indicated that the groups did not know how to circumvent the new ballot law, and that they are merely trying to frighten the people into inactivity. The Australian ballot reminds us how quickly new technologies can spread through an economy. In less than 18 months, the major electoral jurisdictions had adopted the new ballot. "The Australian system is spreading over the country like a wave," exulted one reformer. "It is constantly appearing in places where you would least expect to find a disposition for ballot reform." However, the new system brought new expenses to communities. They not only had to print, distribute, and collect the ballots, they also had to provide enclosed spaces for voters to make their selections. The fittings in Boston cost $35 for each precinct, admitted a Massachusetts official. But as the fixtures were made so as to fold up and be taken away and used from year to year, it's safe to say they do not cost over $5 a year for each precinct, besides, of course, the cost of moving them back and forth. Many jurisdictions tried to reduce the cost of elections by using ballot counting machinery. The introduction of the Australian ballot coincided with the start of the calculating machine industry in the United States. In 1888, William S. Burroughs of St. Louis was marketing his new adding machine, called the Arithmometer, to banks and to businesses. A few miles to the north, Dorr Felt of Chicago was selling a lightweight machine, which he named the Comptometer. In Washington, D.C., Herman Hollerith was testing a more complicated system that used punched cards. Finally, in Rochester, New York, Jacob Myers was completing a geared machine that would record and would tabulate votes. "My present invention," wrote Myers, "provides a means by which an honest vote can be had and counted without liability of voters being intimidated." His machine also prevented individuals from voting more than once for the same candidate, or for different candidates for the same office. The voting machines could also accommodate large numbers of voters and hence make elections less expensive. "There is great economy in using voting machines," observed an official from Buffalo, New York, which first purchased the voting machines in 1900. With them, the city was able to reduce the number of election districts by 30%, which also reduced the size of the election staff. The savings in these and other ways is estimated to be over $10,000 a year, wrote the official, a sum which will pay the entire cost of the machines in about 5 years. The technologies of 1900 did not completely solve the problem of voter fraud, nor could they easily expand to meet the demands of a growing electorate. In spite of claims to the contrary, voting machines proved to be expensive to store, expensive to maintain, and expensive to transport. By 1960, as populations moved to suburbs, jurisdictions looked for cheaper and more reliable ways to count the vote. Many of them turned to punch card ballots for the same reason that companies turned to punch card information systems. Such systems were relatively inexpensive. Manual punch cards cost little and were easy to use. Tabulators could count the ballots from dozens, if not hundreds, of punches. Almost from the start, punched card voting machines proved to be sensitive devices. It was the age when the warning, "Do not fold, spindle, or mutilate," was stamped on cards. Even skilled business organizations could have trouble with the most well-maintained system and the most carefully punched cards. Election system cards, which were scored to make it easier for the voter, were difficult to tabulate accurately. Given the inherent physical characteristics of these ballots and the variability in ballot punching performance of real voters, it is generally not possible to exactly duplicate a count obtained on pre-scored punch cards, argued Roy Saltman, the major critic of this technology. Saltman saw problems beyond the task of tabulating votes at a single precinct. Increasingly, election officials were transferring precinct totals mechanically, or even electronically. As jurisdictions rarely had a well-conceived plan for controlling these transfers, they often found it difficult to secure the election, to identify the key places where votes could be added or ignored or transferred from one candidate to another like so many beans in the hands of an ill-reputed bean counter. In 1988, when Saltzman wrote his report, almost half of the country used punch card voting machines, and no jurisdictions were prepared to abandon the technology. Change often comes through the force of wholesale embarrassment, and no one had been sufficiently embarrassed to drop an inexpensive technology. No election failure of the 1980s, and there were many, forced jurisdictions to abandon punched cards. The 2000 election, of course, badly embarrassed the state of Florida, thoroughly frightening election officials in the remaining states, and forced Congress to look at voting technology. From the start, most people realized that voting machinery posed both political and technical problems. Explaining such problems to the people who must do the technical work is not quick, nor is it easy. Ideas that seem obvious to the engineer, to the programmer, to the system designer, must be debated and discussed, and even misunderstood for a time, before the people who will use them can honestly accept them. There seems to be no other way to balance those often conflicting requirements of our democracy. I must say that neither Francis nor Gerald has been happy with the progress of voting technology since the 2000 election. Francis, in something that seems to me completely typical of an aged lefty, once invited me to a hanging Chad party, an event where the attendees flung little bits of paper around the U.S. Capitol in an attempt to push somebody into some kind of action. I saw the results on the sidewalk, but I didn't think that anyone other than the street cleaners took any notice. Gerald has cornered me several times, as he is wont to do. "You have some influence," he says. A flattering claim, but far from true. "Can't you get them to dump those stupid voting machines?" I suspect that Gerald believes that the nation would be better off if everyone shared his ideas and opinions. Francis probably believes the same thing. If either gets his way, then we won't need to build better voting machines. We'll all think alike, so we'll be able to get better bean counters. You've been listening to In Our Time. It's drawn from the November 2007 issue of Computer. More about Computer can be found at www.computer.org. Click on the button that says Technical Magazines. Other Computer Society podcasts can be found at www.computer.org/podcasts. If you have any comments, we'd be glad to hear them. You can send them to podcasts@computer.org. The music for this podcast, by the way, came from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network And you can find them at music.podshow.com. We thank them very much for the music. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.